So I know I talked real fast. I'm informed I have more time than I thought I had, so I'll try to talk a little slower. If you don't understand something, yell, and I'll say it again, probably just as fast, but after three or four times.
We wouldn't mind going home early to start our turkey, you know.
Understood, but there's a trade-off between comprehensibility and speed. So hopefully we'll get you out of here by 9 or 9:10. So this talk is supposed to be talking about the big picture, but after hearing about radiation and torture, this is probably a little more small picture. But there you have it. So what's the big picture? So a lot of stuff people say when they talk about vulnerabilities in software is they talk about details. They talk about stuff like, you know, buffer overflows and how do you stop them and what kind of tooling would you use and that kind of stuff. And although my background's in computer security, I'm actually not that interested in that stuff. I'm interested in looking at the big picture and at, you know, the 100,000 foot view. This stuff's all kind of the same. So what's the bottom line? If you have a piece of software, software is written by programmers, which means that it's like completely littered with bugs. And as long as we still have people writing it, it's going to be that way. And Steve Bellavin likes to point out, if you have security-relevant software, well, those bugs probably are security bugs. And, you know, in any piece of software that's a multi-user system, which basically means a networked computer of any kind now, which basically means every computer, then a bug turns into something that's important and something you have to worry about, as opposed to just software doesn't function. So how do we choose appropriate behaviors in terms of dealing with this kind of stuff? So as I say, it's sort of intuitive to look at the small picture and say, well, you know, what if I told my programmers they couldn't use stern copy, or, you know, I ran the tool, some tool or something like that. But at the big picture, you know, you have to decide, well, where should I put my money and what kind of policy should I be employing? And if you think about something like, it's not software, like, you know, keeping your house free of termites, well, the exact kind of bug spray you use isn't really what's important. The question is about how much bug spray should you be doing and what's the payoff from bug spraying in general. So what's the kind of policies and what are appropriate levels of investment to be applying? So the standard tool for all this stuff, of course, if you're an economist or a policy guy, is to use cost-benefit analysis. But to do that actually requires some data on the costs and benefits of the things you're working on, and we're sort of laughably short of that. This talk has five big sections. So the first section I want to talk about the vulnerability life cycle, and I want to talk about sort of the phases of vulnerability goes through, so we have a common jargon about what we're talking about. And the second thing I want to talk about is, along that, is some common assumptions people make and the sort of intuitive model people have about how vulnerabilities behave and how we actually use things. Then I want to talk about two pieces of work that I've been working on that basically are about empirical data on the discovery of vulnerabilities and how people patch in response to the publication of vulnerabilities. I want to talk about the big unknown questions in the field, namely sort of the bottom line here is that we know a lot less than we'd like to, and we only know sort of very small pieces of the equation. So I want to talk about the questions that we ought to have answers to if we're going to make any kind of rational policies. And then I have just two brief slides. I'm thinking about applying the same kind of mental models that one would have in terms of cost-benefit and transition phases from computer security into something that isn't at all related to computer security. So this figure shows the absolute bog standard life cycle of typical vulnerability, and this particular vulnerability, which I just made up, is one that is handled and released in the best possible way. That is to say that it's found and the vendor is given appropriate time to find a fix and the patch is released in orderly fashion and all that kind of stuff. So obviously at the very beginning the bug gets introduced by somebody. That is, some programmer screws up and now, you know, we have a piece of software which ought to work, now has this vulnerability. And there's some extended period of time, which can be anything from 2 weeks to 10 years, where the vulnerability just sits there in the software. And it's not doing anything. Nobody notices. It's just hanging out there. And because it's latent and because it's hanging out there, it's not doing anybody any harm. It's just there. And right now I want to mention this is a very counterintuitive view of the universe, because most people think about, oh, the software is like riddled with bugs. It's really bad. But you got to remember that if nobody knows about the vulnerability, it might as well not be there. And that's good news, because any random piece of software has like hundreds of these things. So at some point in the future, and this is where things start to get bad, someone notices the vulnerability. And In the best case, it's discovered by someone who's not malicious, either it's discovered by the vendor or it's discovered by some sort of white hat or gray hat researcher, and they don't just decide to exploit it, they tell the vendor. And so then we get...
Gray hat researcher?
The bottom line is, okay, so the typical terminology here is white hat and gray hat, and black hat. The black hats are guys who are attacking your systems, and the white hats are guys who are trying to defend them. But the bottom line is that a lot of the people whose business it is to find vulnerabilities and publish them basically make money by doing that. The way they make money is you get famous by finding vulnerabilities, and then people pay you to tell them more about vulnerabilities. And it's not clear that this is really something. And there's always been a lot of controversy about whether this is a good thing or not. There are rumors that some of these guys also feed vulnerabilities into the black hat community. Certainly some of them sometimes get them out of the black hat community as well. Then there's some extended period where the vendor tries to, like, hurries up and tries to develop a fix. And at some point they get an acceptable fix, and often this is under intense pressure from the researchers who, of course, want to publish the results. And then, assuming things go orderly, the vendor and the researcher typically co-publish the fix, and then some details of the thing are published, and then people have some opportunity to patch, and there's this long period where they can patch. Sometimes shortly thereafter, sometimes immediately thereafter, sometimes a long time thereafter, someone designs an exploit for the vulnerability. So, I mean, remember that just because the details are out there doesn't mean anybody actually has software that will allow you to take over somebody's machine. So, an exploit is the tool you need to do that. The time between publication and exploit is shrinking pretty radically now. We're down to about, I don't know, order a week to 2 weeks. Is sort of the number of people talk about anecdotally. And it's not that uncommon to see an exploit published at the exact same time as the vulnerability itself was published. Anyway, so sometimes the exploits are published, sometimes they're used privately, but the bottom line is, after the exploit is created, there's some extended period where units are being attacked by people in possession of the exploit. And as I say, sometimes that's just the person who developed it, and sometimes that's the universe at large if the exploit was published. And then sometime, hypothetically in the future, all the units in the field will be fixed, and then the exploit will be no good anymore. Now, this is extremely hypothetical because in practice, it's really common to see systems which, you know, have exploits in them that are years old, and we've seen worms that have exploited really old exploits. So, there's a bunch of common assumptions people make about the way all this process works, and these are all very intuitive, and no one has any good data on any of these, but I'm going to go through them anyway, and I'll try to indicate where people know anything about this and where they don't. So everybody sort of assumes that somehow the number of vulnerabilities in software is somehow scales with the size of the piece of software. And so you've got some number of lines of code, and it's really common to talk about vulnerabilities per lines of code. And I actually had before a slide that showed the vulnerabilities per lines of code in the Linux kernel by someone's estimation. But everyone sort of assumes that there's some variability about in terms of how good the programmers are that controls what the density of vulnerabilities are, but nobody really knows. In order to do this, you have to have some surefire way to detect all the vulnerabilities, and nobody has one. But everybody sort of has this as their mental model. Then we have the rate of discovery, which presumably somehow is related to the quality of the code. There's some sort of assumption that the first derivative is positive and the second derivative is negative. That is to say that if the code is really littered with vulnerabilities, well, it does get more vulnerabilities discovered, but not probably linearly with the number of vulnerabilities there actually are. After a while, people get tired, or, you know, you just have so many, it doesn't matter. No one understands this relationship either, and no one really understands if you do a sort of a panel study of, you know, different pieces of software, what controls how many vulnerabilities are found. In particular, there are programs like, say, SendMail, where enormous numbers of vulnerabilities have been found, and nobody knows if they're really worse than other programs that are comparable, or if it's just attackers, like, got really excited and thought that SendMail would be a good target and started working on it. No one knows if having source code really makes it much easier or not. It seems like it ought to, but there's no real good data. So without being able to control for a level of effort or any of this stuff, nobody knows anything. What we do have is, you know, Windows has so many vulnerabilities and Linux has so many, but nobody knows what that actually means. Similarly, we don't really know what makes a vulnerability more likely to be turned into an exploit. Some subset get turned into them more and more. Nobody knows what subset controls that subset, and nobody knows on what time frame, you know, that's likely to happen in any way except for aggregate statistics of how often it happens. There's some anecdotal evidence that it's getting shorter. Also, nobody knows how likely it is that a vulnerability... So there's sort of there's automatic exploits and there's manual exploits. That is, there's an exploit that's basically something you could like run yourself, and then an exploit is like in a worm. And nobody really has any idea what controls whether an exploit has turned into a worm or not. And this, of course, keys into the question of what vulnerabilities will actually be used operationally, or just have exploits that sit on the shelf somewhere. Again, presumably, having an exploit is a precondition to using a worm in an attack, but, sorry, using a vulnerability in an attack, but nobody knows what controls that. Yes?
So is this a social mystery or a technical mystery?
It's social mystery. There are lots of exploits that easily were wormable that haven't been wormed, for instance. And the data we have on even what vulnerabilities are being used isn't really that great. There's sort of the honeypot data is the state of the art, but it's not clear how representative the honeypots are. So nobody knows what controls the attack rate either. In particular, what nobody knows is if suddenly there were twice as many vulnerabilities a month being published on Windows, would that double the rate of attack on Windows? And that seems like a very important thing to know, but nobody knows it. And finally, we have no real notion of what the loss due to the attacks is. Again, this presumably somehow scales the number of attacks, and some of the attacks are targeted and some of them aren't, but we really don't know, if there were twice as many attacks, would that be twice as bad? It probably wouldn't be, just due to, usual diminishing returns kind of theories. So all this keys into, but nevertheless, despite the fact that nobody knows anything, everybody still has a sort of intuitive model of the universe. And that is, if you're running software that has a lot of vulnerabilities, you're probably at risk, so you shouldn't be running that kind of software. The more latent vulnerabilities there are means the more vulnerabilities will be discovered, which means you get attacked more likely. So people will, for instance, say, don't run sendmail. It's presumably has like lots of vulnerabilities in it, because it used to, at least. Everybody assumes that vendor quality improvement reduces risk, and Microsoft in particular has burned an enormous amount of sort of people's energy and computrons trying to improve the quality of their software, and they actually have done a reasonably good job in terms of reducing the number of vulnerabilities that are published per month between, say, Windows NT and Windows 2000. Everybody sort of inherently assumes that the release of vulnerabilities increases the risks. So, the more attack sites are available, the more people are likely to attack you. This, of course, has to be matched against the fact that everybody assumes that patching decreases risk. So, there's a counterweight here where you say, okay, I release the vulnerability to give you an opportunity to patch, but on the other hand, that vulnerability had a window of exposure associated with it. So, everybody sort of assumes, again, that the less vulnerabilities are exposed in people's systems, the less attacks there will be. So this brings us to the sort of the empirical section of the talk. Actually, I want to page back here, if I can make this work. The only things that we have any really good data about, well, any data at all really, are this section of the operation and the patching section of the operation. Everything else is a complete mystery, and I'll be talking about these two sections here, but they're sort of only partly a mystery, which I guess is better.
I had a question on this slide here. It seems to me that I would have expected intuitively that exploit creation, at least in a certain number of the cases, to actually precede the publication and fix release date.
It absolutely does in many cases. This is the best case scenario.
Oh, this is the, okay.
The worst case scenario is when exploit creation goes back to here. So I want to talk briefly about some of the empirical data we have on this topic. So the overall question people are interested in, or at least have been for years, is, and this has been a really ongoing debate, is finding vulnerabilities a socially useful proposition? So obviously, an enormous amount of effort is invested in this. Their whole companies have done basically nothing but this. Is this worth doing? And there's been, this has been an extremely vicious debate over the years with remarkably little data, and I've done some work trying to add some data to this, although I don't think I have a definitive answer. The benefits and the costs are relatively obvious. The basic value proposition for this kind of effort is basically preemption. There are all these vulnerabilities in your software. You want to find and fix the vulnerabilities before the bad guys exploit them. There are some secondary arguments, namely that there's an incentive provided for the vendor that if the vendor sees a lot of vulnerabilities published, they have more incentive to make their software better, so they try to avoid that, and that there's some research going on in terms of understanding how to exploit and defend software better. The unfortunate part here about the research argument is that if you look at the vulnerabilities that are published on, say, Full Disclosure or BugTrack, what you find is they're almost all the same kind of thing. It's like, wow, another buffer overflow somewhere in some input handling routine. And so it's really hard to argue that this actually is advancing the state of the art in understanding security at all. Occasionally, it's a new class of vulnerability discovered. Mostly, it's a sort of same old crap. The costs are also fairly obvious. If you believe to any extent that the attack level and the cost of attacks scales with the number of vulnerabilities published, then continuing to publish vulnerabilities has a cost associated with it. And if you don't believe that, then why bother with a patching exercise? And in fact, most attacks are based on known problems. If you look at the sort of big famous worms, they've all been based on vulnerabilities that have been published previously. And say Code Red, in fact, was based on quite an old vulnerability. There's an obvious cost to the vendor to develop fixes, and there are costs to the administrators to install them, and the research, of course, is expensive. So simplifying things dramatically, we have two vulnerability scenarios, one which I call white hat discovery, which is the one essentially that was shown on a previous slide, in which a vulnerability is found by someone who's more or less a good guy, in that they follow the disclosure procedure, and they tell the vendor, and the vendor does an orderly release, so you don't have an exploit preceding the vulnerability being published and fixed. And the other one is black hat discovery, where the vulnerability is found by a bad guy who then exploits it, and eventually the vulnerability is rediscovered. So these curves, and I hasten to say, are not to scale, are designed to give you some sort of just intuitive model of what I'm talking about here. So this is the white hat discovery curve, which looks basically like that timeline, except it's got a second dimension here. So at the top, we have basically the number of vulnerable machines, and at the bottom, we have something like the intrusion rate or the cost of intrusions. And since I say they're not to scale, you can think of it as either one. So as before, we have at the beginning, we have an induction phase where the bug is introduced. It's in there latent. It's eventually discovered. And then we have some fixed development phase. And then nothing happens up until the point of disclosure because no one knows about it but the vendor and the good guys. At the point of disclosure, two things happen. One is that people start patching their machines, and we see this slow curve, which you'll have to take my word looks like this for the moment, although I'll argue for it later, of people patching their machines. And then we have sort of this sort of, I don't know, everybody sort of assumes this curve looks like this, but nobody really knows, of exploitation over time, where initially there's not very much exploitation because nobody really knows about the vulnerability, and then someone builds an exploit, and people get more excited about it, and it starts happening more and more, and then as the number of machines who are glad the vulnerability decreases, or people get bored and want new things, the exploitation rate goes down, and eventually, as I said before, hypothetically it goes to zero, but typically it doesn't really. So there's some. So the important thing here is that the area under the curve here is the societal cost. If you ignore the value accreted by the attackers in doing the attacks of this vulnerability. So that was the good case scenario, and the bad scenario looks almost the same, except for this sort of section right here, which is basically in between discovery and disclosure and fixed release. There's some time period where the attackers get to attack the system without anybody having any defense against it. Now. It's important to ask what caused the disclosure event here and the fixed development. And the assumption is that eventually someone rediscovers the vulnerability, or more likely, someone notices that their system has been compromised and they reverse engineer what happened. That actually has happened in a number of cases. So, as I say, I hasten to say this is not to scale. And no one really knows the relative size of this section here and this section here. So I'm just going to sort of wave those away with symbols for the moment, and we can talk about later what the size might actually be. Yes.
I feel like the shape of your curve is sort of against my instinct, which is that the first people to patch are also the most important machines.
Yes. This has been suggested a number of times. It's not clear that's the case. It's not clear that the people most important machines are the first to patch. And I've got some slides on this later. One thing is that, you know, that basically, so I patch almost right away, but if you run a big company, you can't afford to patch right away. But you have to make sure you have to go test the patches in some test lab and make sure they actually work. So that defers the time period for starters. But yeah, the other thing is that the most important machines are the ones that most attractive attack immediately, though that depends on a certain psychological model of how the attackers behave, and as I said before, we don't understand that very much. But you're right, the shape of these curves, like, I'm hand waving here. Given that sort of mental model, that lets us do some very simple cost-benefit analysis. Clearly, it's obviously better to have white hat discovery than black hat discovery if you have a choice. And the cost difference is precisely the difference between the private and public exploitation phases, whatever those actually look like. So if we have a choice, we should choose white hat discovery. And if we found a vulnerability, but it's not quite the end of the story, because if we found a vulnerability, you still have to ask, should we just close it or should we just sit on it? Or for the vendor, should we fix it or not? In particular, should we call it out publicly or not? because the bug may never be rediscovered, or maybe be discovered by a white hat 2 years down the road, in which case we saved ourselves 2 years of suffering, or maybe discovered much later by a black hat, but you have to remember time value of money. So it's not clear you should disclose in order to do that. So the point you should gain from this analysis is the key point, the key question is the probability of rediscovery, assuming you had estimates for C pub and C prim. So using first-year decision theory, I can attempt to build a model, and frankly, this doesn't merit anything better than first-year decision theory because we don't have good estimates for these numbers anyway. So I'm just trying to give you the right model to have in your head. So we know the cost of patching, we know the cost of discovery, and we assume that all rediscoveries are by black hats. This is an incredibly conservative assumption because, in fact, a lot of rediscoveries are by white hats, and as I said before, those are basically costless because they're no worse than it would have been initially. Precisely because we have such poor data, I'm trying to make as many assumptions as possible that basically make the current procedure, which is ostensive work on research and bugs, look favorable. Because if we're trying to convince people they should do something differently, then you really have to like give them as much benefit out as you can. So anyway, so we have two choices here. We have disclose and not disclose. And if we choose to disclose, then we don't have to worry about the bug being rediscovered because we just announced it. And the cost we definitely incur is CPUB. If we don't disclose, there are two possibilities. If it's rediscovered, and as I say, it's rediscovered with black hats, at some point in the future, we incur CPUB plus CPRIB. If it's not rediscovered, we incur cost zero. So there's some probability of rediscovery. We'll call it PR. And, as I say, first decision theory, we have this cost, and the question is which column should we choose from? So this gives us the key question being this probability of rediscovery. And obviously, at least informally, disclosure pays off if probability is pretty high, and it's a bad idea if probability is pretty low. Now, because we don't have any idea of CPUB and CPRIB, we don't know pretty high and pretty low mean, but if we can work backwards and try to measure PR, then we can try to get ourselves some intuition for what CPUB and PRIB would have to be for these arguments to make sense or not. So, assuming you haven't totally decided that what I just said was bogus, I'll ask you to take one more step with me, and then we get to the data. I'm going to use sort of the world's simplest hand-waving model for this. We assume a program has some number of vulnerabilities, of which some number F will eventually be found. And F could be all of N. We assume, and this is the big contra assumption, that all bugs are equally likely to be found. Now, this clearly isn't true in some sense. Some bugs are easy to find, some bugs are hard to find. But one might imagine that looking at aggregate, they'd be approximately equally easy to find. This may or may not be true, and if it turns out not to be true, then you have to sort of revisit things. But there's a fair amount of data, at least, that the curve is very flat of how long it takes to find things, and so there's some evidence to believe that it might be true. Given that, if you basically do reliability modeling and try to estimate the probability of rediscovery, these are essentially very simple standard reliability modeling techniques. The probability of discovery, of course, is the number of bugs which will eventually be found over the number of total bugs. And if we know the rediscovery rate isn't much as a function of time, we can try to estimate this independently as well. So the experiment here is very simple. We're going to collect data on the rate of bug discovery. We're going to use that data to do a reliability model on the rate of bug finding and ask the question, basically, is it getting harder and harder to find vulnerabilities? Because if it's not, then it basically implies there are essentially a 70 infinite number of vulnerabilities. On the other hand, if it is getting harder, if we're sort of running out of vulnerabilities, that is, there's some finite number, then we ought to see the reliability curve start to look better. Basically, we can use that to estimate the total number of bugs and thereby estimate the sort of expected value of how long it's going to take to find the bug later if you assume they're uniformly distributed. So, the data source I'm using for this is the NIST ICAT database, which is basically a meta database that aggregates data from a bunch of vulnerability databases, and it includes the bug identifier, the CVID, the affected program version information, and the time when the vulnerability is released, modulo some unpleasant data handling problems. The data I used is through May of 2003, but you can use any segment you want. And we need one more data point, which is the time introduction. And so in a procedure I don't recommend as being a lot of fun, you can spend hours and hours searching Google and looking at people's websites trying to figure out at various times when various program version pairs were released. I have the database if you want it, you don't want it. Even getting this for commercial software like Microsoft turns out to be incredibly hard. This figure shows basically the rate of vulnerability disclosure as a function of time from the ICAT database. So at the bottom, we just have the year, and here we have the number of bugs found per month. As you can see, we have this incredibly noisy data set with a lot of spikiness. And so the first challenge we have is, like, deal with that. And so we're going to get rid of that to some extent, but the bottom line is data is really noisy, and so there's only so much we can do. And so the best we can say is this is sort of an evocative kind of picture. It's not a definitive answer. So aside from the fact that the data is already incredibly spiky in this weird way, we have a bunch of other sort of inherent data issues, even if the data were less messy. First of all, we only know about the bugs that are discovered. We have to infer stuff about the undiscovered bugs. And we can sort of make that problem partially go away by assuming, as I say conservatively, that all the bugs that are ever going to be discovered are the ones we've already seen. So again, that improves the probability of rediscovery, at least theoretically. The data is heavily censored both on the right for the bugs that aren't found, and on the left because bugs aren't introduced at the same time. So imagine some piece of software like Linux, right? Linux is 10, 15 years old, and there's been bugs introduced through the entire period. So whatever version you start checkpointing at, well, that's, like, there are already lots of old bugs at that point. There's also lots of noise and errors, and I'm able to remove some of that manually, but the bottom line is we still live with it. So in order to try to remove some of these censoring problems, I basically approach the data in two different ways. One is to take what I call the program's eye view, and the other is what I call the bug's eye view. So the program's eye view, basically we're trying to ask the question, do programs improve over time? So we take all the bugs that are in some program version pair X, say, Windows NT 4. And we have to choose, maybe a little careful to choose program version pairs, because we want them to be genetically independent. The problem here is that we're trying to do aggregate data statistics. And if we choose, 30 different, purely by randomness, we're going to get some curves that look one way and some curves that look another. If we choose, all 30 versions of Linux and treat them as individual data points, then it's incredibly confused because they're all sort of somehow related. So I basically chose four that are genetically dependent. But the key point here is we're looking at bugs regardless of when they're introduced. So the point is that Windows NT 4 is a snapshot in time of a specific set of bugs. And we look at how long it takes bugs in Windows NT 4 to be discovered, regardless of even if they're very old vulnerabilities. And we plot the discovery rate over time, and we look to see if there's a downward trend. Now, this downward trend thing is a bit of a cheat. Initially, I had planned to do straight reliability modeling. And then when I started doing scatter plots on the graphs, I discovered something very unpleasant, which is that there wasn't much of a down. You can only do reliability modeling if there's any kind of trend line at all. And the bottom line is, if you look at this data, it's not because of a trend line. And so, and then you have to consider the possibility that for practical purposes, there's an infinite number of vulnerabilities. So, So what we have here in this diagram is four, as I say, somewhat genetically independent programs: Windows NT 4, Solaris 2.5.1, FreeBSD 4, and Red Hat Linux 6.2.
I'm sorry, Eric. You probably answered this, but I missed it. There are continual changes to Windows NT 4, for example, which means new bugs are continually being introduced.
Outstanding. Good question. This is only things which apply to Windows NT 4 of the specific version, at least theoretically, the specific version that was introduced, in 1997. So now this is a little messy, but at the very least, we can differentiate between service packs because bugs are listed individually for different service packs. Now, if it's for things that aren't in the service pack, they're in some intermediate bug release. Yeah, there's no problem there, but those changes tend to be fairly small. But yeah, no question, this is a messy procedure. The good news is that just for comparison, if you look at, say, things that are in SP4, they're almost all in Windows 4.0 on regular.
Eric, another question.
Yes.
I
don't need to look there, do I?
It's confusing. Yeah.
From San Diego. Doesn't this sort of assume that the set of, whoever is discovering bugs is not changing over time?
I don't think so. In terms of doing trend analysis, assume the aggregate level effort isn't changing over time, which we have no data on one way or the other. But one thing you might imagine is that actually the aggregate level of effort being applied to say a really old package like Windows NT 4 is decreasing, right? Because people start looking in Windows 2000, and they don't look at NT 4, and then they don't even bother to look to see the same vulnerabilities in Windows NT 4. So right. It's entirely possible we have there's distortion in both directions. And it's very hard to factor that out, and nobody knows how to factor the effort level problem. So I know it's not a satisfactory answer, but it's the one I've got. Okay. So put these four programs, and basically, I want you to focus just on the left half of this diagram for a second. And left half is just a pure scatter plot of the number of vulnerabilities per quarter since the introduction of the program. And so, if you just look at this, you know, purely from a qualitative perspective, you can see there's basically no obvious trend line for any program other than Red Hat Linux, which has a beautiful downward trend line. So we could actually do fitting here. Stepping away from the qualitative analysis, I basically applied three different statistical tests to attempt to see if there's a trend line. The sort of standard test when you don't know what you're doing is to do straight linear regression. And if you do linear regression, you only get significant coefficients for Red Hat Linux at all. So the sort of basic standard reliability model everybody uses is something called Go-Okamoto, which is basically an exponential decay curve. And if you do exponential regression, again, you only get a nice-looking curve for Red Hat. And in fact, you can't even fit Windows NT 4 because the overall trend line is upwards. And so basically, you get a singular matrix and it falls to crap. So there's one more sort of trend test that people often use, which is what's called a little plus factor. And you basically assume you've got a Poisson process, and then you have sort of a running estimate of the of whether the trend is up or down. And the sort of this right half of the equation here, the figures here, shows the Laplace factor. And the dotted lines here and here are the 95% confidence intervals for up and down. Because we mostly care about down, I shifted the figures up. And as you can see, basically the only time we're getting a significant Laplace factor below, at the negative confidence interval, is at the very end of the curve, like here and here, and for Red Hat. And you really can't trust the very end of the curve because there's a lot of censoring going on at the very end. So we're not getting what you call strong confirmation as a negative trend, except for Red Hat, which, as I say, is just know how to think about this, right? You always have to pick some set of data points, and it would be a lot more sort of convincing if all of these showed some negative trend. And you're always going to get one that shows negative trends. And to show you how sensitive this is and show you how skeptical you should be any of this, when I originally did this work, the way I picked the program version pairs was I picked the ones, basically the four genetically independent program version pairs that had the highest number of vulnerability counts because I figured that would give me the best data set. And I miscounted. And I picked Red Hat 7.2 instead of Red Hat 7.0 instead of 6.2. And 7.0 doesn't show any trend. So that should give you some kind of the willies about everything, but it should definitely give you the impression that we don't have what you call strong evidence that this is declining. The second view of the universe is to not look at programs due to this problem that was suggested earlier about what kinds of programs. Instead of look at vulnerabilities and say, basically ask the question, how long does it take vulnerabilities to be found once introduced? So instead of looking at the programs, you basically go and you find the first known introduction time of the vulnerability, and then you basically plot age. Because of censoring problems, it's introduced in your cohort, so I'll get to it in a second. But anyway, what we do is look at the rate of discovery from the first introduction. So this figure shows four-year cohorts. Just note on why you have to use year cohorts. You get a natural sort of declination effect because the number of vulnerabilities. If you basically just say how many vulnerabilities are 10 years old, well, it's easy to realize that no vulnerability introduced in 1999 can be 10 years old. And so you naturally get a negative trend line unless you start to cohort it. And so basically, yours is a compromise between bias due to censoring and having a big enough data set. So again, this shows 97 through 2000, and the same bogus statistical tests. And the only place you can sort of get a really good feel that you've got a nice negative trend line is 99, which is a beautiful trend line, and the rest of them are kind of like yuck and flat. Minus, again, the third variant of the curves where I call the censoring. You might not believe this is censoring, but given the quality data set, you should. How can we think about this? When I usually give this talk, I usually start out with a slide that looks like this. We're burning an enormous amount of energy here, finding vulnerabilities and fixing them. And in sort of medicine, the question you ask yourself before you do something like that is, like, is this likely to work? And people talk about first doing no harm and that kind of stuff. And so clearly the data we have available would not meet any reasonable test for the FDA for you to deploy a drug or some kind of new intervention. So that's really quite unhappy making. So even if you don't believe ignore the statistical tests and ignore, anything like that, and just say, look at the sort of the shape of the curve. Are you convinced this is a good idea? And you shouldn't be. So even though the data isn't definitive, the question is, part of the question you should be asking is, you know, what level of confidence should you be before embarking on an effort like this? There's been some other work on this. The sort of most relevant work is by a guy named Andy Osmond at Cambridge, who's done basically the same experiment with programs by going into OpenBSD and looking at the exact vulnerabilities that are found in version 2.3 OpenBSD. And the figures I've seen look almost exactly like the figures I've got, with these sort of noisy scatter plots and basically a flat trend. I'm told Andy's, in the meantime, so that was dated through about 2001. Andy, in the meantime, has gone through 2004, but I haven't seen finished analysis on that data yet, so I can't speak of it. But I'm eagerly awaiting his results, but the bottom line is that I'm not sold yet. And of course, even if you did have one example, the question is that the general pattern. And OpenBSD is a particular edge case because enormous amounts of security investment have been implied to that. One purely anecdotal note, Microsoft has burned an enormous amount of energy in improving the security of Windows 2003, and they managed to achieve basically a factor of three reduction in the number of vulnerabilities found during a time, which looks like a big success. Although, as a practical matter, because of the issues I mentioned before about what the effect of a marginal vulnerability is, it's not clear whether that's a big enough success to be worth doing. Which brings us to the second part of the talk, which is talking about, remember I said earlier, if I can manage to bring the slide up. I apologize for the crappy V8. That we knew about something at the first half, now I'm going to talk about the second half. And I hope I don't bring the slide up again because it's getting sort of clobbered with writing on it. So there's been a fair amount of work, partly by me, partly by Gerard Eschelbeck, on the rate at which people patch their software. So it should be obvious the rate of patching controls the useful lifetime of an exploit. And so the question is, how fast do people actually patch? Because after all, if people don't patch at all, then one exploit is enough for everybody. Although we can't get a definitive answer, clearly the rate of patching is some useful insight into basically the rate below which we have to suppress the vulnerability disclosure in order to be worth having. And also, aside from how fast people actually patch, what kind of predictors tell us what people are likely to patch or not? So the specific piece of research I want to talk about is done on a vulnerability that was announced in July 2002 in OpenSSL, which is a pretty common, which is the standard CSSL package. It's about the worst possible kind of vulnerability. It's a remote code execution vulnerability based on buffer overflow. So you could take control of an SSL server. So this basically affected any OpenSSL-based server which supported SSL version 2, which essentially everybody uses. It affected the Apache SSL web server, the mod SSL web server, which is based on Apache. It affected everybody's SendMail TLS client. And it's incredibly easy to identify such servers because basically you connect to them and they helpfully tell you what kind of server they are. So it's not hard to mount attacks. And it also affected any SSL client that used OpenSSL, but we don't have to worry about that because that's not what we're going to study. These make a fantastic case study for the following reasons. First of all, it's a serious vulnerability. As I said, a remotely exploitable buffer overflow is about as bad as things get in the world. It affected a security package, and at least in theory, the kind of people who deploy SSL for security like care about security and be more likely to patch. So it gives us like a good-looking estimate of how theoretically, you know, fairly conscientious people patch. It's in a server, and it's very widely believed, especially in the kind of people who run OpenSSL, that the kind of people who run servers are smarter than the kind of people who run ordinary machines. And in particular, since OpenSSL is so popular on things like Linux and FreeBSD, those guys absolutely believe they're much smarter than anybody else. Again, those guys should be more conscientious, or at least we know what the smart money does. And finally, it's remotely detectable, which makes it easy to study, and of course, you know, availability is what's most important in terms of observables. So what questions do we want to ask? First of all, what fraction of users actually bother to fix their software, and what kind of time scale do they do it? Given that they apply some kind of fix, what kind of countermeasure do they use? There were three possible things you could do in this particular case. One is you could apply a patch. And the patches were available for all the major versions of OpenSSL, and very often with the vendor supply was basically a patch. You could upgrade the newest version. There were newest versions that didn't have these problems. And you could apply a workaround, and the workaround in this case was incredibly simple if you were a server, which was you turned off SSL version 2, which despite some lore, is actually quite safe to do and is a one-liner in OpenSSL configuration files. And finally, given that we know how users behave, can we get any useful insight onto what factors predict what users are going to do or different users are going to do? methodology here is like incredibly boring and simple, and it's what you expect of a longitudinal study. We collect a sample of servers that use OpenSSL, and we did this by using a methodology pioneered by Eric Murray, which is basically you collect a list of a bunch of random words, and you do Google searches, and you find basically SSL servers that happen to advertise these random words in the meta tags, basically. And then you filter on the servers that advertise OpenSSL. And operationally, what this means is servers to run mod SSL, because it turns out that Apache SSL doesn't tell you that it runs OpenSSL. This gave us a number about 900 servers, actually 892. After turning people off, so what we did basically was on a daily basis, I'd look at their server and see what version they were running and see if it had been fixed. And this annoyed a bunch of people. And so at the end of the day, I ended up with only 890 servers because a bunch of people would complain and say, hey, listen, I don't want you to deploy my server. And my ISP would get these aggressive emails about saying someone's attacking me. And so if you actually want to do a study like this, I can give you some hints on how to make it less likely you get these emails that you're going to get them anyway. So anyway, that gives a nice longitudinal study. I can't help myself because I'm feeling clever about this, so I'm going to bore you for a minute about how you detect the vulnerability. So basically what you do is you non-destructively take advantage of the flaw. The flaw is this thing, it's a buffer overflow in this protocol field called the key argument field, which is only SSLv2 field. So you negotiate SSLv2 and use an overlong key argument field, 1 byte longer. The key arg field gets read into this value in the struct. And the next thing in the struct is this thing called the client master key length. And it happens, when you overwrite by 1 byte, you like write some crap in the master key length. But the good news is that the next thing that happens in the SSL handshake is that the client master key value is read in, and that gets written into the client master key length, the length does, and so the fact that you've scribbled in this thing doesn't do any harm at all. So it's perfectly safe, but it gives you a great diagnostic probe, which is nice because like this is research, not vandalism, so I don't want to crash the guy's server if I could possibly avoid it. But ask me afterwards about why it does crash the server sometimes. So in theory, the probe is harmless but diagnostic, and the implementation is thrown error. But the way you know a broken implementation is you actually successfully complete the handshake to the server. So when you do this over the course of a month, you get this really nice looking data set, actually. On the bottom we have time and days, and on the left side we have the vulnerability percentage. This data point up here, by the way, is a synthetic data point. I wasn't able to measure it, but like the bottom line is that if you had an OpenSSL server on day zero, you were vulnerable. So I think you can take my word for this data point.
How do you know it's because you don't come back every day?
I could be making them patch more aggressively. The good news is this probe isn't very noticeable, so unless you're the kind of person who's incredibly conscientious, you're probably not going to notice the probe either. And if you are, you're probably the kind of person who patches. That's my theory. But yes, this may be an overestimate how aggressive people are. The dotted line shows basically, I love these exponential fits, so I'm just going to keep showing them to you all day. Shows the exponential fit of basically the standard decay curve of the data, and we're getting like this really nice looking R-squared value, so you should be happy about that. But the interesting thing here is that the bottom of this curve is 60%. And if you look at the exponential, basically the floor of the exponential is that is about 60%. So basically, the projection of if you don't do anything else, of the number of people at the end of the day who won't have patched is 60%. And I have these slides in the wrong order, but I'll show this to you anyway. You can believe that because this is the figure we get, and here we are at 60% until the day a worm is released that exploits this vulnerability, and then things start to change again. So you ought to believe that would have happened until the end of time. So, secondary question, what kind of fixes do people deploy? As I say, there are three options. You could upgrade, you could patch, or you could apply a workaround. And the bottom line is that most people upgrade or patch. Almost everybody upgrade or patch. And the workaround doesn't even show in this diagram because I never saw more than 8 servers that have done it, which is a little surprising, and I'll get that in a second. The other thing that's a little interesting is this jump here. Which actually is like a couple of big hosting service providers all operating on the same day. So upgrading and patching are equally a problem. So one question you might ask is, why didn't anybody use a workaround? It was incredibly simple, it was complete protection, and basically nobody did it. So why not? I got a bunch of guesses, they're not not definitive answers. The advisories were kind of unclear. Not all of them said you could do this as a workaround. And some suggested, in fact, that any application you had that ran OpenSSL was unsafe, which was completely untrue. It was perfectly fine at the time if you were doing something like OpenSSH that only used OpenSSH for crypto. It was also quite easy to install the patches, and so one theory is anybody smart enough to figure out any of this stuff just used a fix instead of trying to do the workaround. A third possibility, which I don't have here, and I wish I did, is that there's some lore in the community that there are still people out in the world who only have SSL version 2 browsers, and so that you'd be making them unable to talk to you. That isn't actually true, but people believe that. It is true, by the way, however, that there, until very recently, were SSL version 2 only servers, but not an issue here. So I've got a bunch of incredibly detailed logistic regression analysis of what predicted people's responsiveness, but I'll just summarize it for you here, because I find people sort of fade off when I show them the regression tables. So two big pieces of information. People who are running big hosting service providers, like if you're Vireo, you fix a lot faster. No one really knows why. Theories are bigger service providers have better staff, they're more professional, whatever. They may have more money on the lines, they have lots of people using their stuff. The people who were least good were basically independent servers, which didn't appear to be hosting service providers at all. One thing I want to note here is that if you press me, I'll explain what I mean by hosting service provider in terms of how we detect it. It's not easy to do, but it's a rough and ready categorization, but the effect is quite strong. Hosting service provider is my interpretation of a particular data point, which you a particular observable. Second, people already up to date, that is, if they're already running the latest version of OpenSSL or a fairly recent one, upgrade faster. Why? Maybe it's a signal of active maintenance, that if you're the kind of person upgrades anyway, or maybe you're just more willing to upgrade in principle, so it's less disruption to you. So I said earlier a while, about 45 days after the original disclosure, someone released a worm that exploited this vulnerability. And so basically they had this nice flat line at around 60%, and they set off an entirely new round of patching, which also can be fitted to this beautiful little exponential curve with an even better looking R squared. And again, we get this sort of nice thing where it flattens out around 30%, and it just sort of hangs out there. So basically, the noticeable thing is that even after there's actually a worm exploiting this vulnerability, there's still a substantial residual population of unpatched servers. So why did we get so much post-worm response? Again, nobody knows. Maybe people didn't hear it the first time. That doesn't seem very likely because it was published through all the same channels, CNET and Slashdot and whatever. One possibility is that people are actually being quite rational, and why should I do anything when there's only this potential threat as opposed to a real threat? And yet another possibility is people are purely interrupt driven, and so some people patch interrupt one and see how patch interrupt two, and they'll just forget basically. Again, this is sort of the overall curve of the shape of the data with no fitting at all, you can absolutely see when the worm was released. It's not even surprising. This is one data point, or one set of data points. So you might ask how things changed. Two things have changed in the environment that you might have thought would change people's behavior. One is automatic patching. In terms of software that supports automatic patching, has become much more common. So both Windows and Macintosh, and to some extent Linux, support basically internal automatic patching. And the threat environment has gotten substantially more hostile. You continuously read articles about how if you turn on the wireless on your Windows NT machine for more than a second and a half, you'll instantly be infected by 500 viruses. And I don't know if this is actually true or not, but people believe it's true. The answer, however, is not very much. Gerard Eschelbeck has been running a bunch of surveys on different vulnerabilities over the past few years, and he claims that at the moment, the half-life of an externally visible system of a vulnerability in that system is now 19 days. One thing that's interesting to note is he doesn't see the sort of two-hump curve, one before worm and one after. So he has to harmonize those data sets. And he says that the internally visible systems, so you get about a 48-day half-life. According to Eschelbeck, things have improved some since 2003, but only by about 30%. And 19 days is still incredibly long. And I hear claims, claims, that vulnerabilities are routinely released within the first week or two. So it's not clear this is fast enough. And One more conclusion to draw from this, if you think about it for a second, is that if it takes basically 19 to 30 days to reduce the number of infected machines by a factor of two, then how many vulnerabilities a year does it require to basically keep a constant population of infected of machines that are easily infected? And the answer, of course, is what? 12. Maybe 20. So all this, of course, is sort of ways of coming at this big open question that we really care about, that we want to answer, which is, where should we be spending our stinking money? And there's some sub-questions about this. How much do vulnerabilities cost us? And how much would the defenses we're trying to do cost us? And do these defenses actually work? And if we had answers to these sort of sub-questions, we might be able to have, an interesting kind of discussion about this question here. At the moment, we only barely can have that. Lots of people have opinions, but we can't have anything that looks like cost-benefit analysis. I think all of these are big, hard questions. So my next slide shows some smaller, somewhat easier questions. They're still hard questions that if we had answers to those, we might be able to approach the bigger, harder ones. First of all, what are the predictors of the discovered vulnerability rate? Is it software quality? Is it popularity of the software? Does it matter if you have access to the source code? So there's been a lot of discussion in particular about open source versus closed source security, but nobody has any good answers that could tell you anything useful. So you see articles that say, oh, Linux has so many vulnerabilities per month, and Windows has so many, but nobody knows what's controlling this, whether it's actually the source code or level of effort or how much people hate Microsoft or any of that stuff. And in particular, Firefox, right, has just started throwing off enormous numbers of vulnerabilities, almost exactly the same as IE. Now, Firefox, to the extent, however much it sucks, has sucked that much for 5 years now. And IE has sucked the same amount for 5 years now. So, why has it suddenly changed? Nobody knows. Presumably effort level. What is the marginal impact of a new vulnerability? But the point you should be drawing from that, of course, is that you can't draw any reasonable conclusions, you can't draw any really good conclusions from the rate at which vulnerabilities are currently being discovered as to how good the software is. Given that we have some set of vulnerabilities out there, what's the marginal impact of a new vulnerability in terms of the total number of attacks and the cost of attacks? I've seen some work, which I'm not very happy with, about the impact of a single vulnerability release on that vulnerability being attacked. But it's not the same thing as doing anything at aggregate level, because it may just be attackers are shifting from vulnerability A to vulnerability B. And we have no good information up for the question you asked earlier of what the cost of attacks is in terms of marginal increase of vulnerabilities. We don't really know anything about the marginal impact of faster patching. This would be interesting to try to model if you had good statistics on vulnerability exploitation. We don't know how much it reduces risk, and there's been some work by Seth Beatty and some other people on basically trying to balance patch quality and expected probability that the patch will break your system versus the risk of the vulnerability. The work they've done is basically on patch quality, and they try to extend it to drawing conclusions about when you want to patch, and I've got a paper, or more like a write-up, of why I'm not very satisfied with that approach. I think the data on patch recall rates is fine. It's just a matter of you can't draw any conclusions from it. There's been a lot of discussion, especially lately, informed by sort of biological analogies on having diversity, on the idea that if you had software that was more diverse, you might be able to protect yourself against things like worms. How well this works depends to a great extent on A, whether attacks are targeted or untargeted, and B, you don't know, maybe just bad diversity. Diversity is easy to counter if you knew enough, is good enough. And so, for instance, there's a piece of software called PAX, which randomizes the address space of the program, and Havad Shalkum and some others have shown that with something like 30 to 60,000 probes, you can figure out what the address randomization layout in a particular program is and infect it. But maybe that's good enough. That slows things down by a factor of 30,000, but nobody knows because nobody understands the attack model well enough. So if we get answers to any of these questions would make good papers and would move us along the way to understand the bigger questions. So final thing I want to talk about, and I've only got two slides about this, is taking this sort of same mental model, which we've been talking about all along, about vulnerabilities and release and exploitation, and think about something that isn't related to computers at all, which is namely bioweapons. So you can think about bioweapons and viruses as kind of like software, in that you've got these vulnerabilities, and they have they're published, and then they're exploits, and but it's all that parameters are 10 times worse. So these vulnerabilities are incredibly long-standing. Whatever bug in my immune system that lets me get smallpox has been there for millennia. And that's bad. Now, it's true the exploits are hard to create, but the bad news is, like, lots of plenty of old exploits, you know, and we haven't really managed to wipe out any substantial number of them, with smallpox being the one exception. And technology is making it much easier to create new exploits every single day. Now, the fixes for these exploits are, like, incredibly hard to create. I mean, when you know there's a vulnerability in Windows, basically it's, you know, a matter of a couple days to a week or whatever to patch the vulnerability. But, like, guys have been working on HIV vaccines for 10 or 15 years now, and, like, you notice we don't have them yet. So, and it's also this crappy signature-based stuff, too. Because, I mean, so, you know, if you want to, when you find some buffer overflow in a piece of software, you fix that buffer overflow, and no exploit that exploited overflow will work. But, like, we don't get that here. What we get is, like, oh, the specific viral signature of, like, HIV, we can defend against that, but, like, if it changes at all, we're totally hosed. And that happens naturally, in that, you know, every year influenza changes the protein code a little bit, and we have to roll out new flu viruses. But it can also happen, you can also counter this stuff in a very programmed fashion. There's an interesting slash horrifying paper by Jackson et al. In 2001, showing that basically if you wire in the right gene into mousepox is ordinarily fairly innocuous and mice get it and they don't really die very much. If you wire the appropriate gene into mousepox, A, it burns the mouse population like crazy and kills essentially every mouse, and B, vaccination barely works. So there's no reason to believe this can't be applied to smallpox, and there's a big, there was a big fuss when this came out, but no one's done it yet. Even once you have that fix, applying that fix is like unbelievably slow. I mean, so we have like a perfectly good fix for measles, and yet there are like people around the world buying measles every single day because like we just can't roll the patches out fast enough. So none of this stuff is very good. The parameters are all much, much worse. So you can imagine asking exactly the same sorts of questions. You say like, what's the marginal cost of like, you know, a new vulnerability, for instance? And we have a case where this actually came up in a public policy setting, which is the 1918 influenza reconstruction, which happened this year. And a bunch of scientists published, I don't remember their names, published basically the complete sequence of 1918 influenza. You remember this was a bad flu year. Not only did they publish that, they published like diffs between like ordinary influenza and 1918 flu. And not only that, they like, figured out like for each variant gene, for each allele, basically which alleles were important in terms of making it more virulent. So essentially, you know, given this, you can essentially create a patch file to turn like regular flu into something ostensibly really bad. A usual naysayer, Bill Joy, and an unusual naysayer, Ray Kurzweil, publishes an article in the New York Times complaining about this and about how it's horribly, horribly responsible. And they may be right, but they may be wrong. And so I want to encourage you to think about this in sort of in terms of the model I was discussing before and ask what's the marginal cost of this new vulnerability or new exploit being published. So, as I say, we already have plenty of diseases that exist and aren't weaponized, and it's fairly easy to weaponize other new things. And in particular, smallpox, which is really bad, and makes an incredibly good bioweapon, has already been fully sequenced. Vaccination levels are quite low. The vaccine has nasty side effects, so it's not like you want to vaccinate everybody, which is why we didn't in the past 3 or 4 years. And as I mentioned from the mousepox works previously, it's quite plausible that you could make smallpox much nastier than it already is. And at the moment, it's a little difficult. Your average Ben scientist doesn't have a copy of smallpox. Now, this virus has been sequenced. You can get it, like, the sequence on the web. But, you know, you can't call up, you know, Aldrich and order a copy of smallpox, although God knows how many Russian smallpox strains have been actually sent out in the world. But given the sequence, it's not that hard, in theory, to de novo synthesize the virus in bench chemistry. It certainly, if it's not possible now, it'll be possible in the next 5 years. So, given that there are already lots of things you could already do, how much does one new example exploit cause in terms of cost? And nobody has a good answer to this question either, but it's the kind of thing you need to think about in terms of this framework.
Questions from San Diego?
Yeah, so I'll take questions.
From San Diego? Hi. Your biological analogy is real interesting, and I kind of think that it's common sense that people go to a lot of trouble to avoid getting smallpox or measles or whatever, or the flu. And it occurs to me that we don't know much about what makes people avoid getting viruses. And I wonder if it would be interesting to get a study on how much education could contribute to not getting hacked.
Well, one thing we know, we actually do know a fair amount about this, it turns out, and the answer is incredibly simple, and it's hand washing. I mean, we know there's other stuff too, but the one thing, as far as I can tell, makes the most difference is like washing your hands. But I agree, education, teaching people to wash their hands, if you ever watch people like, you know, not wash their hands, it's quite striking. So I totally agree, education should be worth having. Anybody else?
I have two questions. I think he meant hygiene for viruses, and I am rather amazed that we don't have simple public service spots or CSI episodes in which people do things like fishing and teach the general population what everybody in this room seems to...
Oh, I understand.
Sophisticated.
I totally misunderstood. Thank you. I wish I didn't give you such a flip answer then. I think that actually would be interesting. There has been actually sort of a modest amount of education. The bad news is that that going back to what I said earlier, we're not entirely sure what to do. There's some things we can tell people what to do. Like when you see like someone says you an XE, don't click on it. That much we can tell you to do. And people have tried to train people how to do that. It turns out, as far as I can tell, the data is a little fuzzy, that it's incredibly hard to train people to do this. Like basically, like so if you look at like, you know, there are lots of viruses that spread via executable files. And now modern like mailers pop up the dialog boxes. You must be insane if you're gonna click on this button. You know, you click on this button, some program will run that someone sent you, like only an idiot would click on this button, and yet these viruses continue to spread. So I'm not sure what kind of we can teach people, but it's not easy. But I think it would help some.
Okay, so one of the things that I've been toying with in this course is that it seems to me that there's a fairly good analogy between open source and this hacker exploit community. And it comes down to basically the fact that in a proprietary system like Microsoft, the value that the participant gains is tied to the social value, that eventually he gets a share of what the program is worth to the society. In the open source analogy, you get paid by strange things like reputation and incentive that aren't tied necessarily to the social value. And our instinct is that those things are often smaller than the proprietary reward that you would get in the standard proprietary system. And if you take that to the hacker community, people are presumably creating exploits for reasons that are not particularly tied to the damage that's done to the society. They're doing it for the same sort of open source incentives about reputation and education and whatever, where you could tell stories like that. And that leaves open the possibility that somebody who can actually tap into the value, the true value to the society, could offer a bigger reward and divert that activity, which is a long-winded way of saying, would it be feasible to do something like a prize? There seems to be a sort of a naive view that this would be giving in to terrorists. But in fact, you could sort of just divert the entire field of activity and leave the black hat community. Most of those people would prefer to just do the profit maximizing thing, you imagine. Well, so is there a sense in which you can just change the whole game? Is there room for that?
I used to think there was, and I'm not sure there isn't. In fact, this talk used to have a slide that said buying up loose nukes. There are two concerns. The concerns are usually raised when one says this. The first is that the incentives have started to change a bit, which is that a lot of vulnerabilities now are used to basically build botnet zombie networks. Mm-hmm. And those guys have a direct financial incentive in exploiting software. The second is it's not clear that it's not clear there's a sort of finite pool of this effort. It's not clear there's a finite pool of vulnerabilities, it's not clear there's a finite pool of effort. And so the question is, you know, is would you have a big enough suppressive effect? And then what are you going to do? And then even if you had that, what are you going to do with the vulnerabilities once you discover them? You're going to pay these people to find them, and they're going to hide them. So that gives people sort of the willies, especially I think from a liability perspective. But I agree, this is a very interesting thing to think about, and incentives I think are critically important, and nobody understands them in any useful way.
Anybody else?
Two more questions from San Diego. One on behalf of Stefan, and then I'll follow up with a second one. Stefan's question is, what are your thoughts about the larger scale impacts of ongoing disclosure? For example, while it may exacerbate the problem in the short term, that same increase motivates significant expenditures on security, which may ultimately reduce problems.
Well, so the big question that we have to be asking is there something useful? So, all right, then you might spend on security, right? So there are two things, two big places you can spend security money on. One is you can spend it trying to make your software better so there are fewer vulnerabilities. And the second place is you can spend it like making, you know, your systems more defensible in some way that isn't related to fixing your software. So, you know, things like firewalls, virus scanning, that kind of stuff. It seems to me the second category of things is almost entirely driven by some combination of fear and exploitation. So I doubt that, and it's basically pure deadweight loss. So I suspect that disclosure isn't improving that situation at all. The argument gets often made, and I sort of hinted at it earlier, that vulnerabilities incentivize the vendors to do a better job. And there certainly is some evidence that it incentivizes Microsoft to exert more effort in making the software more secure. The question is there any level of effort that Microsoft or any other vendor could apply that would make a big enough dent in the pool of exploitable vulnerabilities that it would significantly decrease the cost of attacks? And that's exactly the question that I'm interested in answering, but I don't have a useful answer to it. My intuition is no, but that doesn't mean it's right.
Okay. Now that I think about it, I actually have two questions. Two questions about cost. From Microsoft's perspective, they may have a cost in terms of spending all of this time, effort, money on finding vulnerabilities, getting patches out there, and maybe it actually exacerbates a problem. But that's actually that's a smaller cost than they're worried about, which is a marketing cost. They have to worry about the fact that they're perceived as not doing the right thing, and so they're afraid of losing market share.
I absolutely agree their behavior is rational, although I'm not actually sure they're going to lose market share, but I actually agree that the marketing thing was killing them, and I think it was totally rational. I think that, in fact, you're starting to see people, analysts saying things like, oh, you have to worry about Macintosh and Firefox, and that's like a complete victory, right? I mean, if people stop thinking Microsoft's insecure software, that's an enormous win, even if the actual picture hasn't changed at all.
And then the second question about cost is, what was not discussed is sort of what the cost is to black hats in terms of discovering and exploiting vulnerabilities. And if that cost could change, how, do you see this landscape changing dramatically?
Well, so the cost of black hats, as far as I understand it, is basically twofold. One is effort cost, and the other is, is whatever cost it costs them to, do anything useful with it. The effort cost, as far as I can tell, is quite small. Everything I hear from my relatively weak contacts in the black hat community is that, like, finding vulnerabilities is trivially easy. So that leaves us basically something that changed the landscape to make it harder to actually use those bugs once you have them, and there's been a lot of work there, but I find it extremely unsatisfactory. So, yeah, if we, had better mechanisms for making vulnerabilities less useful, that would be great. But if you read the literature, I'm not very impressed with it. The only literature that seems to be when they're making much progress at all is sort of attempting to deter very broad-scale exploitation, kind of the stuff that Stefan's been doing or over in Pexin. But in terms of making individual packages less susceptible, I don't see much evidence that's really changing much.
Question from Washington here. Shadow. Okay, in your analysis, it seems like you're ignoring the growth of the install base of software and the resultant damage that can happen as the software spreads. Like, an extreme example would be, say, it's 1980 and I'm a white heterosexual, and I notice there's a fundamental flaw in the IP protocol, and I just sit on it.
Yep.
So, it seems like this would be a support for get it over with now. Find the vulnerabilities as early as you can. Get fixes out there, regardless of what the immediate impact is. Because down the road, you'll have to fix them anyway.
Right. This is the
as the install base grows, especially into things like embedded systems. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be upgrading your refrigerator every 2 weeks, when someone says you can't order beer from your refrigerator or whatever.
Sure. Well, this is absolutely a classic preemption argument. But that only makes sense if the vulnerabilities you're disclosing and fixing now substantially decreases the number of vulnerabilities that we disclose and fix later. And if there's a very small number of them, sure. If there's an infinite number, then it doesn't do any good. So I think we need to answer that question effectively. We don't have a good answer for that. But Yeah, I mean, absolutely. If you believe a very small number and you believe that the install base is going higher, it's worth doing.
Well, at the same time, there's also the argument that if there's a particular program that you find yourself patching over and over and over, or that you as a researcher keep finding vulnerabilities in, that would tend to drive you to using some alternative to it. Like the example that you brought up with sendmail. Sendmail is something that people have found vulnerabilities in forever, and it's broke enough that they'll always be finding vulnerabilities in. A lot of people switch to other alternatives for their mailers. So
yep.
It seems like you want to know before you invest everything in some particular piece of software.
Well, as I said, that's an argument people often make, and this is sort of you get information about the quality of the software by the number of vulnerabilities you find. But so I have two responses to that. One is might there be some proxy that would give you that information without the concomitant externality? For instance, imagine there was some piece of software you could run in it that would find signals of bad programming that didn't actually find vulnerabilities. People talk about that thing with rats or something like this. And the second thing is that there's a big assumption there, which is the number of vulnerabilities that are actually found in a piece of software are in some sense indicative of the underlying quality of the software. And that's part of why we raised the issue of Firefox, which, had very low vulnerability rates for years and now is right up there with Internet Explorer. So Firefox hasn't suddenly gotten much worse, it's just gotten more popular.
Okay.
Anything else?
Thanks, Eric.
So
thank you very much.
Before I hang up, I'll make my pitch now, which is that unfortunately I'm not an academic, and so I'm doing this sort of in what spare time I have. So if there's someone out there who's maybe a student and is interested in working on some of this stuff, I'd be really interested in hearing from you. I have a bunch of nerd stuff that I think is worth doing. And my email address is here.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for getting here.
Happy Thanksgiving, all.